Now, our panel this morning, Alan Cawley is an RTÉ soccer analyst. Lucinda Creighton is the CEO of Vulcan Consulting and former European Affairs Minister. Pat Rabbit is chair of TUSLA and former leader of the Labour Party. Paul Somerville is a market analyst. Jennifer Bray is a political reporter with the Irish Times. And Jerry Stenbridge is a writer and director. So plenty on the panel this morning. But first, before I come to the panel, we're going to bring someone else to the party. Eamon Dunphy, good morning.
Good morning, Brandon.
So, Eamon, you've obviously been following what's been going on in the last overnight and everything. I suppose, Eamon, was the tipping point for all of this was the Oireachtas Committee, was it, and John Delaney's appearance there?
Yes, not just his appearance, but the appearance of a number of FAI officials, including the president of the FAI. They were stonewalling. Delaney said nothing for 8 hours. There was a feeling that they were contemptuous of the committee. It was troubling in many ways, not least the lack of power that the committee had.
The lack of power that the committee perceived it had, certainly.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, you know, the Fergus O'Dowd, the chair of the committee, was clearly very nervous and agitated. The Cairns judgment in the Supreme Court and the data referendum we had has circumscribed the power of an Oireachtas committee to do its job, which is to find out in the public interest what people in power and people receiving government money are doing. And this exercise on Wednesday really shocked people because of the arrogance and the dismissive attitude of the witnesses, the FAI.
Well, and John Delaney, I think in particular, people were fairly disgusted by that, weren't they?
Yeah, I think people don't like to see someone with his power, profile, and indeed he says that he cares about the grassroots in soccer, the people who follow soccer, not providing those people with an account of how he and the association had behaved, and doing so in a very, very dismissive way. It looked very bad.
He would have been better off in a way, and not turning up, wouldn't he? And like he wasn't obliged to turn up.
The big mistake he made, Brandon, was the injunction he took against the Sunday Times and Mark Tighe. They got a great story.
You think that was the beginning of it?
Well, it was, because he gave $100,000 loan to the FAI from his own personal account. Now, people usually get done for stealing money, not for giving money. If he'd have let that story run, but he overreacted, he went for a super injunction, he failed, and I think that was his first mistake, and a number of other mistakes have followed on to leave him now a very discredited figure in the eyes of the football community in particular. The other intervention by Michael Healy-Ray on Wednesday, who wasn't even a member of the committee, I think added an element of farce.
So, Eamon, are you kind of saying that this was actually about miscalculation of the optics of lots of things, and
yes,
that actually John Delaney could have got through all this without too much trouble, and that he substantially has done nothing seriously wrong, but it was the way he chose to play it, basically?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see a massive scandal here of money misappropriated. What I do see is somebody who has become far too powerful and is surrounded by sort of yes men and one woman who got out of control and, you know, who really has been heading for a fall. But I don't see, you know, any grand larceny here.
Okay.
Abuse of power, yes.
Okay, okay. Without getting into the details of the story in the Sunday Times this morning, what do you make of those latest revelations?
Well, they're damaging because people expect of Delaney, and this has been his mantra all the time, I care for the grassroots, I care for the little people, I look after people who love the game, I love the game. And then you see extravagance on the scale that Mark Tye, Anderson, The Times depicted. So that's it's a good story. It's good journalism, and it shows what's going on behind the rhetoric and behind all of the so-called goodwill and this phrase, the football family that they have invented. Behind all of that, you see quite extravagant behaviour. And when you add that to the abuse of power we saw on Wednesday and the dismissive attitude to the public and indeed to the public's representatives, then the FAI has a problem. It will have a problem with its sponsors. It needs to do something, and it needs to really make changes, and it needs to do it very quick.
I suppose the one thing that is said in his defence, I'll bring in the panel now, guys. The one thing that is said in Delaney's defence right now by even his detractors is that he is a useful figure for Ireland out in UEFA. Yeah. What do you make of that argument?
I think it's a good argument. In the Euro 2020 finals next year, we have four games in Dublin. We've had a Europa League final in the Aviva Stadium. We have other important matches and tournaments coming to Ireland in the 2020s, and we're part of a bid with England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland for the 2030 World Cup. John Delaney has done a lot of good, and his presence on that committee is very helpful to Ireland, but he can only remain on that committee, as I understand it, as long as he has an executive position with his own association, the FAI.
Or is it that he cannot run for that committee again? He's in there till 2021,
yes, exactly.
Now, regardless, isn't he?
Yeah. Yes, but he can't run again unless he retained the executive position that was designed for him in Gibraltar 3 weeks ago. That's another problem. That's corporate governance issues. That wasn't an open competition for that position. He is now an executive vice president of the FAI. No one else was allowed to apply for that position. That's a corporate governance matter that will have to be dealt with. So he has a problem retaining his position in UEFA unless he can come to a deal with the FAI, but I don't think that's possible.
Okay, Eamon, will you stay with us? Alan Cawley, before you were an RT soccer analyst, you were a League of Ireland player, and I think one thing that has emerged over the last few days for people who might not have known a lot about the football scene in Ireland is that the League of Ireland seems very much like a Cinderella in all of this, and that the League of Ireland, the clubs were very much the victims of whatever messing was going on in the FAI.
Yeah, well, John Delaney himself called it the problem child in an interview going back, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago. So there's always been that feeling out there, Brendan, for us as players involved and from people certainly looking in from the outside, that it was neglected in a serious way for years, because I suppose the focus has always been on the senior team because that's the main revenue earner for the association. And also, I always felt John put a lot of emphasis on the grassroots, which was fine in terms of trying.
And why did he do that?
Because that's where you build up your power base. And because of the clout that the junior council clubs had and the members of that kind of council themselves over the League of Ireland, they had serious sway when it came to re-electing people and electing people onto the board and stuff like that. So I always felt that was why the emphasis was put solely on that. And I'm not saying anything was wrong in that in terms of people are entitled to, obviously, facilities and certainly small clubs and for the good of the game, but there was far too much emphasis on that, and it was almost upside down that I felt the highest level of football you can play at here in this country is the League of Ireland, and they were putting all the focus and all the investment into grassroots, and there wasn't enough focus going on to the domestic game here, which is the reason you see so many clubs struggling, and have been struggling for a long, long time here. The prize money has been halved since 2007, and when you look at some of the revelations in the paper today, people focus on the salary that John Delaney has been earning, and you look at the paltry sums that have been given towards the League of Ireland here, it just turns people's stomach.
Can I ask you, your average, we call it journeyman League of Ireland player, what's he earning?
Well, it depends on the club that you're at. Obviously, Dundalk and Shamrock Rovers, the bigger clubs, maybe Cork City would be paying up to maybe £1,000 a week for certain players. But on average, then, if you look at around the other clubs, maybe from probably fourth place down to 10th place in the Premier Division, you're probably talking £400 or £500 on average a week. Then you're getting into First Division, you're talking about lads probably paying for £50 a week. I know managers in First Division clubs who negotiation contracts with players for £50, £75.
Okay.
And the problem with that, you see the game evolving at such a rate, and we've been left behind. I've said this for a long time now, Brendan. You look at, and I'm not talking about the Premier League or big, huge leagues and associations like that, where obviously there's huge money involved, but countries of a similar stature to ourselves or a similar size or similar population, the likes of the Scandinavian countries, you look at the resources and the facilities they have because of the investment that their associations has put back into the game there at their highest level of football. And they're way ahead. We're 25, 30 years behind where we should be in terms of our domestic game.
OK, so what needs to be done for the game?
Well, I think with all the revelations that have gone on in the last 3 or 4 weeks, I think there's a good starting point in terms of the CEO looking like he maybe moved on. And I would also call for, I think, Fergus O'Dowd, the chair, in his summary at the end of the meeting, call for the whole lot of the board to move on. And I think that's the case. They've been there a very, very long time. And I don't think the game will ever get any better until we have fresh ideas and fresh investment and fresh voices in terms of the game and an appetite and a desire to make the game improve here.
OK.
There's
Pat
been
Roberts,
no desire
what,
on their
what
part.
What do you make of all this?
I think governance of a big sporting organisation is, politics with a small p. And there comes a time when you can't resist the tide. And the tide has really reached the level now where I think it impacts not just on John Delaney, but on the people who have been around for so long. And it really, Keith Duggan in the Irish Times pointed this out yesterday in a splendid piece, and there's reference today. I mean, his performance before the Oireachtas Committee just simply wasn't acceptable. He was not obliged to appear, but it is the National Parliament and it is the widest played game in the country. Or soccer people would certainly argue that. The Cairns, to seek to hide behind the Cairns judgment is a nonsense. The Cairns judgment is very precise. It prevents Oireachtas, where an Oireachtas committee trespasses on its own terms of reference or goes outside its own remit, then it may be patrolled by the courts in the event of resort to the courts. It did not prevent John Delaney coming in and saying whatever the position is.
OK, so that's the first half, at least, of the Cairns judgment. We don't know the full outcome of that yet. But did the committee not know that?
Well, it would appear that it had something of a chilling effect on the committee, or that their legal advisers were so ultra cautious that they couldn't ask. Now, there are some members of Dáil Éireann who don't know how to ask questions. You know, they confuse it with imparting information. And, you know, maybe some of the questioning wasn't as sharp as it ought to be. But nonetheless, the fact of the matter is it's the National Parliament. He agreed to come before them. And if he has a case to make, and after his long years in the service of the FAI, he presumably has a case to make, he should have set it out rather than seeking to shelter behind legal advice.
Lucinda Creighton, I assume you're not a member of what we would call the football family. What are you making of this from your standpoint?
Why would you make such an assumption, Brendan?
I just have a feeling.
Are you part? Back immediately.
Would it actually be more disgraceful at this stage? The football family now is not in great repute at the moment.
What should I say? No, I'm probably not a huge soccer fan, but I suppose I have been entertained in the exploits of the FAI, like lots of people, over the last number of years. I mean, I think, you know, there's a great article actually by Colm McCarthy in the Sunday Independent today, and he kind of hits the nail on the head as usual. And he points out that, you know, if you compare, you know, similar organisations or large organisations across the Irish state to the FAI in terms of turnover, revenue, in terms of employees. If you take Dublin City Council, for example, they employ 5,300 people compared to the 200 that the FAI employ, yet the manager manager of Dublin City Council, who's arguably a lot more responsibility in terms of delivering housing and infrastructure and services for the people of Dublin, earns €175,000 a year. And obviously John Delaney has been earning significantly more than that. There's something just wrong with that.
Colin McCarthy
what is wrong with this country that we think that that is acceptable and that we have in place a governance structure in the FAI whereby board members stand over that and believe that's acceptable. If you look at, and the other point that Colin McCarthy makes is, you know, comparing it to similar organisations like Irish Rugby, like the GAA, and how they have reformed and modernised their structures in keeping with what is expected in this day and age. And clearly the FAI has not done that. So I would wholeheartedly agree with the proposition that the organisation needs a radical revamp. The board needs to go, frankly. There needs to be an entirely new system of governance in the organisation. And I would expect, whatever about RoCTS committees, which are generally speaking fairly toothless when it comes to holding organisations to account irrespective of the current judgment or otherwise, but the Office of the Director of Corporate Enforcement is where the authority lies to investigate what has gone on here and genuinely hold people to account, and I think that's what needs to happen now.
Yeah, Dan O'Brien compares our committees today to like Zuckerberg in front of Congress, for example, and the 10-hour grilling that he got compared to what happened the other day. Jerry Stembridge, Lucinda Creighton is basically saying that the whole edifice is rotten.
Look, there's a trough. If you reach these positions, there is a trough to be fed at. It just is there. No matter who's in the positions, that will be the case. You don't need to be particularly porcine in order to enjoy the pleasures of it. What I don't understand with people like John Delaney is that when they know, you know, this has been good, now it's time for me to go. I've had a good run at this. It's been very pleasurable. But I am not some kind of heavenly creature on whom the FAI depends, entirely to be able to feature. And the same applies to the board. They seem to think we can just stay here forever, feeding at this trough. And really, they should be the ones that are saying, it's time for us to go. I mean, we're there, journalists, everybody is sick of saying, go, go, go.
That's a bit of a sweeping statement about all of them.
Oh, it's a totally sweeping statement.
I think we can get into a situation at times like this where you feel you can say anything you want about anyone involved.
No, no, because I'm not going in that direction. What I'm saying is that, let's put a name on it, there should be term limits. Any normal board should have term limits. It's not the Chinese government. Do you know what I mean? They, after a while, people should say, you know, we need a bit of new blood. We need to move on. What I'm saying is that these people, if in the absence of any legal way to do it, they should be making the choice.
Other national governing bodies for other sports do have term limits. I'm a director on one of our sporting organisations, Horse Sport Ireland, and I have a term limit, and rightly so. You know, this is not tolerated in other organisations.
On some of those current members that are there now, they have brought in term limits recently enough, but it's still going out until, I think, 2022 and 2023 and stuff, after them being there for such a period of time as it is.
There's a text here, and I think this is an angle on it. Once again, populist politicians and media call for a head and it is delivered. No justice. What a country we have been become. And it's from an Eamon.
I'm not calling for it, it's not Eamon Dunphy.
Just wait a second.
Is there an element here
of a good old-fashioned Irish hop on as well?
Yes, I think there is. And one point I would make, Philip Brown, for example, has been an outstanding in his role, the same role John Delaney held for the FAI. He's the IRFU head, and he's been over 20 years in his job. But I will say about John Delaney, he's the most energetic, visionary and able football administrator in the country. And when or if he's lost to soccer, it will be damaging. It will damage Irish soccer. He won't be easily replaced. And even with the board, I think Fergus O'Dowd, the chair of the Oireachtas Committee, said regime change was what was needed. Yes, but who's going to replace them?
You see, that argument doesn't address Colin McCarthy's article in the Sunday Independent today, where he traces the comparable performance over the years of the GAA and rugby associates. And, you know, I chair a body that has 4,000 employees, that has 15 times the budget of the FAI, and where the chief executive is paid less than half the chief executive of the FAI. Now, there must be, in any walk of life, there is comparability, and comparators are put in place in terms of when framing a salary. And I don't know what Philip Brown or the GAA new director.
But with respect, Pat, nobody was defending the salary. The point I'm making is, and in a response to Brendan's question, and it's a good question, is this a good old-fashioned lynching? It is. And this guy has real ability, real vision, and has done an awful lot for soccer in this country.
Alan Colley, you look disgusted by that.
Well, I wouldn't say disgusted. Myself and Eamon have had a few barnies over the time, and we've had plenty of agreements as well. But to suggest that John Delaney is indispensable is just ludicrous, in my opinion.
I'm not suggesting he's indispensable. But what I'm saying is, Colin, you can't ignore that the energy, ability, and achievement that there is there, and
there's no other talent, also crazy.
That's fine, Eamon, and to be fair, I think that's been acknowledged. Plenty of people have said there's been good work.
And Stephen Hunt is in the Sunday Independent. Yeah. He says Irish football is in very good shape, and this happened under John Delaney's tenure. Would you disagree with that?
Yeah, I would actually. Yeah, to be honest with you, I would totally.
And
fair enough, Eamon's not saying he's indispensable, and people are acknowledging there is good, but you look at the way things have carried out over the last 3 or 4 weeks, to be honest with you, Brendan, and I think it's been absolutely pathetic as well. And you look at people, not just people who are involved in football, also people from the outside who have been monitoring this for a long, long time. Their appearance during the week was absolutely deplorable, in my opinion. You look at the timeline of events since this has taken place, since this story first broke on the 17th of March over the 100 grand loan. 6 days later, he was moved aside to this made-up role that nobody had ever come across before, or nobody had ever heard.
Well, it was recommended
about
by the Jonathan Hall.
Yeah, but it was all a bit coincidental that it was recommended 6 days after these stories just broke, in my opinion. Now, then to go into the Oireachtas Committee and they're hiding behind the Mazars report and also the Grant Thornton report. There needs to be a forensic, independent audit carried out of all their accounts and everything else and all their business after what we have been reading and seeing over the last number of weeks, in my opinion.
Okay, Jennifer Bray.
I just want to say that, you know, as a political journalist, I've covered various different committees, from the banking inquiry to the committee on the 8th and public accounts committee on various health issues. And I don't think I've ever really seen anything like what happened last week. I think, as Eamon said, there was a huge amount of shock and disgust that that committee not only proved to be so ineffectual, but also that on the other side, the FAI kind of put their metaphorical hand over their mouth, and John Delaney wouldn't really answer any questions. And, you know, in the Sunday Times actually today, Justine McCarthy makes the case for perhaps a permanent Office of Public Investigation. She says this could overcome compellability issues and perhaps be headed by a superior court judge, because clearly the members of the committee felt that they were legally hamstrung. Whether they were or weren't, that's how they felt. And it came across really clearly. They were in and out of public session. It was actually extraordinary. And I would agree with the point that was made on the panel that I think by Pat, that a lot of politicians do mistake the sort of monologue for when they could be getting really good, sharp questions in there from their witnesses, and that didn't happen.
And a suggestion as well, I think that Noel Rock and Imelda Munster probably didn't help with their interventions in advance of the committee.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, look, politicians will do what they do, and they obviously want to get their name out there, etc. We shouldn't be too surprised at that. But, you know, the performance of politicians, I guess, is totally separate to this in terms of the actual functioning of the committees. Clearly ineffectual. And, you know, it was really hoped that this committee would get to the bottom of some really obvious, like, straightforward questions. The first being, why was this money needed? We obviously know there was a cash flow issue, but it's not that. It's why was it needed? The second was, why was it never recorded as a note in the accounts? And there's many such easy questions that should have been answered and it wasn't. And it's so surprising
that the Honorary Treasurer didn't even know how many accounts they had, Brendan.
Yes, it went from
like
one
simple
to
questions, basic
think.
Questions. Yeah. There was 8, I think, outlined that Donal Conway, the President, said, we'll come back to you. I think the people are still waiting on those answers. They haven't come back to them yet. And these are simple,
basic
questions.
Yeah, but it did seem that
questions.
Most of those people had only been in their jobs for a week or two, in fairness.
No, well, that was one. Yeah.
Paul Somerville.
Well, I find this story very uninteresting, I have to say. I mean, we've seen this so many times over the years in Ireland, and it's one of these things where in 2 weeks' time we won't be talking about this at all. He will move on. The main question here is that body has been given 50 million of taxpayer money in the last decade. Has that money been spent officially? We don't know. So you need to go up somewhere to account for that. And that's what they tried to do this week and it didn't work.
So Elaine Byrne is suggesting today in the Business Post. Yeah, go on.
That's what I was going to get onto. Yeah. So there's two very interesting articles, one from Justine McCarthy and one from Elaine Byrne, fantastic journalists, both questioning why they are in front of an Oireachtas committee, because it doesn't actually work. And they're both providing different types of solutions. But I think most people in Ireland should read these articles, because it's very clear that we're going to have the same problem in a few weeks' time. And it'll be another body, because this is how Ireland works. It works you know, people are giving out about the salary as if we don't know about the salary. Eamon Dunphy's talking about the salary is outrageous. Well, Eamon Dunphy has been commenting on football for the past 50 years. Why hasn't he mentioned this before? I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous that
Eamon?
Well, I think I've been commenting on it, Paul, with the greatest respect, for well over 40 years and raging against it. So, I mean, you can't accuse me of being a friend of the FAI.
What I'd like to say is that what salary do you believe is appropriate? Why are you saying today that his salary is not appropriate?
I didn't say... What I would say about his salary is that, like a lot of people in the Celtic Tiger era, and he came to power in the Celtic Tiger era, his salary was very high. And inflated. His salary is an issue for, you know, discussion. But he was...
Was he worth it, Eamon? While the going was good, was he worth it?
Well, I think the best comparison is with Philip Brown in the IRFU equivalent position, or the president of the GAA equivalent positions. And I don't really think whether he was worth the salary of 370,000, which he actually took a cut. He was on over 400,000 at one stage, and it wasn't appropriate. And I did write about it. So did all the other football journalists say.
I'm not suggesting the salary is appropriate. What I'm suggesting is there should be a method for these salaries to be adjudicated. So, again, in Ireland, we only talk about the salaries once the scandal breaks, is what I'm suggesting. For an example, the front page of the Sunday Times today is talking about his expenses. I don't see there's any relevance in talking about this man's expenses, because it's to do with the corporate governance of the board. Now, they have responsibility here. So if they have okayed these expenses, then that is something that they must step down and resign. But what I'm saying is, it's such a small story, and it's such a story that we see in Ireland all the time. And I would say we'll be back here in 3 months talking about another organisation.
Eamon, does Paul have a point there? That this is a corporate governance issue involving the board of an organisation. John Delaney, because perhaps of his personal style and everything, has become a lightning rod for this. Would you consider yourself a friend of John Delaney's?
No, I'm not a friend. I mean, I can't be a friend of John Delaney's. I mean, I have to write about the FAI like many other soccer journalists, and many journalists have been frustrated by Delaney and have written very critically about him for years.
Okay, but do you think, I think you possibly have a more nuanced view on this than a lot of people
do.
And there is a mixture of, you know, it's like personal relationship that a lot of other people don't have, so you're humanising him a bit more. Is there an element, do you think, of a good man being done down here?
No, there's an element of a dynamic and creative and passionate lover of soccer, no question about that, who has accumulated far too much power, been allowed to accumulate far too much power, and has ended up abusing the power.
Okay, Jerry Stenbridge wants to come back there.
You see, the question, is, I think, is framed incorrectly. It's not about trying to do somebody down or take a head. A guy does a job, a woman does a job, they do it for a number of years, they may do it really well, they may do it badly, but their time comes and they move on and they give it to somebody else. That is the nature of it. But
in Ireland, they never ever leave. And he's lauded about this grassroots stuff almost to the point where people are thinking he's coming down giving the money out of his own pocket. Exactly. A lot of this is grants. Like, he's doing his job. job. And for him going down as the CEO to be opening up a pitch or cutting a ribbon, he probably shouldn't even be there. That should be maybe an honorary president or an honorary treasurer does something like that.
Players.
He should be looking after the business side of things of the role. And for them to find themselves in a position where, obviously, if checks are cashed and their overdraft is going to be kind of gone over, well then, he wasn't looking after the business side of things.
Eamon, is that the nub of it there? That this guy was around like some kind of a gombeen politician around the country, buying people pints and singing songs and opening pitches when he should have been running the FAI properly?
I think his power derived from the grassroots, and it was clear with Michael Healy-Red's intervention, for example, and the other gentleman from the Kerry Football Association. Yes, that's where his power derived, and that's where the votes came from, and he cultivated that.
So that's what he was looking after.
Yes, and ultimately abused it. There's no doubt about that, and you can see that.
And listen, was the other thing he was looking after was his contacts out with UEFA? Because we seem to have come to a position now where we think that John Delaney's the only man in Ireland who has an in with UEFA, and that is there a sense, if we lose him, oh my God, we'll be cut off by UEFA because he's well networked in there.
Well, I think he spent an awful lot of time ingratiating himself, politicking with UEFA, and he's done it very successfully to the point where he is now on UEFA's steering committee, which is the most powerful committee. He's the first Irish person to be on that committee. As a result of him being on that committee, we have four games in the Euro Championship Finals in Dublin next summer. We are bidding for the World Cup in 2030. He has done these kinds of things by being...
The 33rd team in the World Cup, wasn't that John Delaney's special?
Well, Eamon, before we wrap this up...
Steve Staunton, wasn't that John Delaney's special?
If you look at the trials and tribulations that, say, the Olympic Council of Ireland went through as well, and since they've been reformed, they've thrived as an organisation. So the suggestion that if John Delaney leaves the FAI, all of a sudden we're going to go backwards is a nonsense.
Okay, Eamon, before we finish up, there's a texter here, and I just want to hear some of them. Texter here says he is a friend. 50th birthday party.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were at John Delaney's 50th birthday party.
Everybody
were you?
Was at John Delaney's.
Yeah, you see, I don't think you'd have to be a friend of John Delaney's to be invited to his birthday party.
I was on table 89. So I don't think anyone who knows what or watches or hears or listens, I am a real serious critic of John Delaney and the FAI and have been
CEO,
consistently.
Not a great CEO.
He's. I was at his birthday party and there was a lot of people there. It was in a big tent in Mount Juliet. I thought I saw you there, Brendan, but maybe it was a lookalike.
Okay, Eamon, thanks a million for joining us. And Alan Cawley, thank you very much for coming in as well. And we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back. Now, our panel, just to remind you, are still here. Lucinda Creighton, Pat Rabbit, Paul Somerville, Jennifer Bray and Jerry Stembridge. The texts are piling in. I'll just read a few. Brendan, I usually agree with Eamon Dunphy, but Irish football is far from being in good shape. If this is energetic vision at work, we really are lost. Irish football is a mess. And that's from Jay in Lucan. Tony in Kerry says the government must be delighted with the diversion of the FAI. The Children's Hospital debacle has slipped out of the headlines. A much more significant waste of public money. Go after personalities is the easy way out. Senator Aon O'Riordan says FAI staff were taking pay cuts and the women's team were changing out of their tracksuits in airport toilets during this entire period. And another texter here says, when Eamon speaks so glowingly of John Delaney's superb ability, what are his thoughts on the very fundamental mistreatment of ladies' soccer that arose just 2 years ago? A visionary that oversaw our ladies' team being treated with a complete lack of common decency and respect. And let's move on. Jennifer Bray, you wanted to talk about this story. It's a small story on the front of the Sunday Business Post, a bigger story inside.
Yeah, so this is a story by Hugh O'Connell. Very interesting. It's quite funny, actually. So it is about how Fine Gael told its staff, some of its staff and party activists, to pose as members of the public and send in tricky questions for Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin when he was just before he did a radio interview late last week. So these came from leaked WhatsApp messages, which show that dozens of Fine Gael staff and activists were told to reword suggested questions in their own voice, because we don't want to make it obvious it's coming from us. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go through some of the questions, and I'll try not to be too narky and insert my own commentary, but I might not be able to resist.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so one of the first questions is, how can we trust Micheál Martin on health? He established the HSE. Now, this is the government, you know, the party that has presided over some serious health disasters like the cervical check controversy, 80,000 women waiting 33 weeks, but anyway. Secondly, why should we trust Fianna Fáil? They destroyed the economy. Again, National Children's Hospital, $1 billion overspent. Really? Are we going there? Is the talent there on the Fianna Fáil frontbenchers? Outside of Micheál Martin and a handful of others, you don't have many household names, and that is a sore point for Fianna Fáil at the moment. Another question, on housing, Dara O'Brien constantly criticised Owen Murphy's background. Is it right to always play the man and not the ball? I mean, the buck stops with Owen Murphy. You have to put it that way.
Yeah, these are not questions that I imagine ordinary members of the public would be putting to Micheál Martin. Like, is anyone at home, a real member of the public, going to say, you know what I'd like to ask him about? I'd like to ask him about the Owen Murphy's background being brought.
They were warned not to send the questions in from email addresses that anyone could recognise. So you have to use anonymous email addresses. And it just shows that talk radio or any radio shows, when they're getting texts in, there's really a huge body of PR machine people working behind the scenes
to get
those questions.
And in defence of the fantastic people who work behind the scenes in radio in Ireland, none of those questions appeared on News Talk. Yes. None of them got through. So somebody was doing something right there. Pat Rabbit, is this, as you might say yourself, is this just the kind of thing you do in politics?
Well, I recall doing a programme chaired by Marianne Finucane when she was running Liveline. Or rather, I recall being slotted to do the programme and forgot it. And I phoned up to apologise and grovel for having forgotten the date. And Marianne Finucane proceeded to tell me that they had received 3 telephone calls complaining about things I said on the programme. So the story today is amusing.
And there wasn't even WhatsApp. There wasn't even WhatsApp back then.
That's right.
Yeah.
There's a great sense of drama. I'm predicting there's a great sense of drama workshop about it all. I see that they suggested that the team should reword the suggestions in your own voice. We don't want to make it obvious it's coming from us. So they have to be, you know, writers and actors as well as activists in Fine Gael these days.
It's almost, this is as far as they can go sometimes, because Fianna Fáil are keeping the government alive and in a job every single day. So if the best way they can go about getting their spoken is through secret, undercover messages.
I think it's that great Irish tradition known as passive aggressive, isn't it? Lucinda, is this kind of carry on one of the reasons you're not in politics anymore?
Oh, God.
Is this really what it all comes down to?
I certainly don't miss this kind of carry on, that's for sure. No, I think this is not exactly groundbreaking. I mean, this is what all of the political parties do. I think some are better at not getting caught, perhaps, than perhaps Fine Gael have been
and
in recent years.
These
things always seem to leak out for Fine Gael from WhatsApp groups.
Yeah, exactly. When will they learn?
Whereas other more clandestine political parties seem to be more effective at doing it without ever being found out. But it's all pretty obvious. I mean, all you have to do is tweet something on Twitter, and you'll get an avalanche of retorts coming from clearly
identifiable. Is the government all spin and no action? And I think, you know, the general population believe that actually the government is particularly spinning. This particular government it spins quite a lot. So I think it's a story that sort of trades on that sort of idea that people already perceive.
Also, the questions aren't exactly incisive, you know. They're not prosecutorial, you know. You're not going to sort of... destroying the Neil Martin's
by the time they reworded them, they were going to be like scalpels.
You're tempting me to mount my hobby horse, Paul. I particularly agree with you because it does seem to me this Fine Gael led government is dangerously, in my view, controlled by this small group of kind of 40-year-old young men in suits who know how to do politics, who know how to do spin, who are very. I mean, I'm obviously talking about Leo. I'm talking about Pascal. I'm talking about Simon Harris, and I'm talking about Owen Murphy. You know, a quartet. They are very much the kitchen cabinet. They're all of a type. They're all very ideologically driven in a certain kind of way. And you know, I really think that they are not good for this country.
They're not good for this country. Would anyone disagree with that?
I think possibly as an unbiased political journalist.
I think that's a little bit harsh. Yeah. I mean, I'm an independent. I don't want to get into party politics, but I think Pascal O'Donoghue has done a superb job as Minister of Finance, so I wouldn't agree with
but
him.
If
there,
but if you take them as a group, that's what I'm talking about. It's a group and they're controlled. I mean, there are no women. There are no women who are able to breach
it's
that.
It's a new type of politics.
I'm inviting Lucinda here who might possibly be able to comment on it. But, you know, it's a form of, it's a particularly kind of group of young men who are all moving
Jerry,
in the
maybe
same
you're
direction.
Being a slight victim of spin yourself and of just looking at the superficialities of things.
I'm just an old conjurer as well.
A couple of things. I mean, the four individuals that you'd mentioned, I'd see a gulf between some of them. So I wouldn't see them as being sort of necessarily aligned in terms of their outlook or their ability, frankly. And I would also
Would you like to get more specific on that?
No. But I would also say that, I mean, obviously politics the world over has become consumed by spin.
It does lead us on to who read the Brian Hayes interview today, because he has a few interesting things to say. Lucinda, as he's about to be ex Fine Gael politician, you might have some insight into this.
Yeah.
He has some interesting things to say about politics in Ireland.
I think the great thing about Brian is that he tends to be, and Pat knows him very well, obviously, from sharing a constituency with him, and I served in a parliamentary party with him and worked very closely with him. And he's a very blunt, direct kind of character. He's also not your typical tribal politician. And you'll find that Brian has kind of friends and allies across the political divide, which I quite like, because I find the kind of phony divides between the political parties in Ireland kind of frustrating. I thought, I was kind of a little bit surprised by his gushing sort of praise of Micheál Martin. He seems to be a really big fan of Micheál Martin.
Now we should bear in mind that Brian Hayes is going on to a job with the Banking Federation. Yeah. He pretty much said everyone would make a great T-shirt, didn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah. And he also, I suppose, I mean, one of the key messages that he delivered was, and he's been, you know, Brian has been working as junior minister for finance and then in the European Parliament, specialising in financial services and regulation around FS, which is obviously hugely important to the Irish economy, etc., etc. And he, you know, he talks about the need to have more of a voice for the private sector in policy making and decision making at government level in Ireland. And I would totally agree with him. I think he's dead right.
He also says that you have to pretend in politics in Ireland that there are easy solutions to everything,
well,
because nobody wants to know that.
That's what gets rewarded. You know, that's what gets rewarded in our electoral system because of our multi-seat constituencies. You know, the trick to getting re-elected is keeping the head down, promising everybody that you'll deliver whatever they want, and doing that to as many groups as widely as possible. And the more you do it, the better you succeed in Irish politics. Fianna Fáil in government for 15 years was the prime example of that, and it's not a whole lot different now.
To some degree, I think, Lucinda, that's probably unavoidable to some degree in the multi-seat proportional representation system, you know. I mean, Brian Hayes has been a very good politician. Mm-hmm. He has been an outstanding member of the European Parliament at a time when it was critical for us to have some clout in the European Parliament. And people like himself and Mairead McGuinness certainly made an impact. He raised an interesting point about that he came into politics too young. And I think that is a good point. He was the exception, but generally speaking, I think coming into politics without ever having done a job in your life is not a good idea. You ought to have some life experience in a real job before you come into politics.
The way Leo Varadkar was a doctor for a short time before.
Well, it was a very short time.
Yeah.
It was a very short time. You know,
Simon Harris, a lot of people would say he's a good politician. He never had a job before.
There's a kind of a thing abroad now, Brendan, that you don't have to serve an apprenticeship. I mean, it used to be the case that you had to serve an apprenticeship. And, you know, I think Brian Hayes' point is a fair one.
And you think it should be an apprenticeship in the real world?
Yes, absolutely. I think that in some walk of life, you know, it enhances your understanding of the issues that you're confronted with as a politician when you're elected nationally, if you have some experience of real life.
He also makes a point. He's talking about the next government, and he says that there could be a resurgence in Labour. He also mentions that maybe we should look at a grand coalition. But he says we've difficult times ahead, and there needs to be a strong government.
Well, I think you have to look at that now through the prism of Brian Hayes's transitioning to a different job.
I think you should all be in government.
You know, the situation, I think, is very tempting now for the Taoiseach. Even though the delay in Brexit is shorter than he would have liked and hoped for. But even within that shorter period, depending on how things happen, this government has reached its sell-by date. You know, Fianna Fáil want this government to be successful, but not yet, and not very successful. And it's not a basis to run the country. This configuration of government, it may be argued, works in Denmark or Holland or somewhere, but I'm not personally persuaded that it works here.
In one sense, the government is very lucky that Brexit has happened, because I think it's making them more popular than they actually would be if we were just talking about domestic policies. Mm. Most of the domestic issues, they have done very, very badly.
Absolutely.
But because Brexit is all over the news, and Simon Coveney, you would have to say, is doing a particularly good job, that is the main reason that they're doing so well in the polls. I would say if Brexit wasn't on the table at all, that this government would be much lower in the polls.
Brexit has kind of acted as some sort of bizarre life support machine for this government. And I think during the Children's Hospital saga, Barry Cowan just blurted out at a press conference one day, if it wasn't for Brexit, they'd be gone. And I think that's reflective of the mood within Fianna Fáil. But this question, really interesting point that Brian Hayes makes about a potential coalition with Sinn Féin. You know, it wasn't that long ago that we had Jim Daly kind of saying he had no objection to this. I mean, this is a question they'll have to answer. Obviously, you can have your ideological objection, etc. But the real problem is, how would you put two parties together that have such fundamental differences? If you want one party that wants to increase taxes on the rich and another that wants to take the opposite road, I mean, how would you come up with a programme for government?
But Jennifer, your point is a partisan one, I suggest, in respect of Brexit keeping the government in place. Nobody would have preferred more to have had a general election in 2018 than the Taoiseach, especially in June and November. He wanted to have an election, but he finds himself with this Brexit problem. But so does Fianna Fáil. It has sheltered Fianna Fáil as well, because they're running behind in the polls, and it suits them that their Brexit is there. So that's what I mean by being partisan. I don't mean you were partisan as a commentator.
Has it run its course, Lucinda?
This government?
Yeah,
I mean, it's impossible to do anything as a minority government. I think actually at this point, both parties would like an election. Perhaps not Micheál Martin, but I do think that the majority of his front bench really want an election. They just want to get on with it.
Okay.
And there's no question that the Taoiseach would like an election. But it's engineering it, you know, in such a way that the timing will work between now and the Brexit deadline.
Okay, we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucan Show at rte.ie/radio.
Now, TD Noel Rock was on to say, any advanced scrutiny ahead of the committee brought about by me and my office had no bearing on Mr. Delaney deciding to divulge virtually nothing to the committee on Wednesday. Saying in advance of a hearing that an organisation has questions to answer should make them more likely to answer them, not less. Any excuse that my statements somehow precluded Mr. Delaney from answering my questions are just that, an excuse. Now, we're going to talk about Brexit briefly, but I think Brexit's moving on in all kinds of different directions. There's a sense that we're thinking, okay, we're going to take a break from all that, but I think there's another sense, if you look at the English papers, that all kinds of terrible things could happen now. Pat Rabbit, you were looking at the Telegraph. The Telegraph is furious at this stage. The Brexit's going to be taken away from them. They seem to want May gone. Today is that Corbyn is bound for number 10 as Tories face 60-seat loss. You were looking at that. What do you make of it all?
No tabloid has reached the level, the decibels of indignation of the Sunday Telegraph this morning, trying to scarify people about what has recently happened. And of course, the prospect of having to participate in MEP elections drives them mad. It's extraordinary that after 12 EU Council meetings, that we still don't know where we stand. And what the Telegraph and the Sunday Observer are pointing to is the pressure on Corbyn in terms of a divided Labour Party, and that the Remain TDs are pressurising him to ensure that if there is any kind of an accord with May, that there would have, it would have to be followed by a confirmatory poll. In other words, a second referendum.
Which probably, realistically, her side aren't going to buy. So are these European elections just going to clarify a situation that they can't come up with?
Yes,
I
think they are a tipping point, that if she wants to avoid European elections and the Tory party desperately want to avoid European elections, then she has to seek to conclude a deal between now and the 22nd of May.
So a customs union.
A customs union.
But
would
will that be enough?
Well, from our point of view, it would be a step forward, but not enough. Because the question of regulatory alignment is a huge issue for the Irish economy. But for the Tories, the customs, well, there won't be a deal with the Labour Party unless customs union is part of it. Now, you know, Corbyn and Labour have no choice but to talk. But whether they can afford to bring what they call a Tory Brexit across the line is something that they will have an eye to. And in those circumstances, you would have to say that it's improbable that there will be an accord between May and Corbyn on this issue.
Lucinda, this is your area of expertise. I know this is an impossible question, but how do you see this panning out likely, or what do you see as being the potential outcomes?
Well, the first thing I would say is I don't see a Theresa May's deal or a deal notionally negotiated with the Labour Party passing in Westminster before the deadline. So,
Is she gone then?
I believe so, yeah. I think there's no way that she can survive one way or the other. I mean, she has already said that she would not. Now, she said lots of things and she's broken lots of her red lines, but she has said that as Prime Minister, she would not lead the UK into a European elections, and that's where they're heading. I mean, they will be running candidates for the European elections. You know, the notion that Jeremy Corbyn, with a whiff of an election on the horizon, will bail out Theresa May's government is just inconceivable, in my opinion, and I don't see it happening.
So May's gone. Are we looking at an election then, do you think?
I think it's quite likely. There are no certainties in this bizarre sort of a parallel universe that exists in the UK at the moment in British politics.
And with potentially a Brexiteer, a Boris, now leading the Conservatives.
Yeah, so the problem, I think, is that only a Brexiteer can win the leadership. I'm not convinced it'll be Boris Johnson, because he's deeply unpopular with his parliamentary colleagues. They don't trust him. They don't like him. They know he's a charlatan. Somebody like Michael Gove probably is in a stronger position. Sajid David. There are a number of frontbench Brexiteers who are perceived to be slightly more moderate and are possibly more palatable. If there is a hard Brexiteer leader who tries to take them in a harder direction, in other words, effectively saying they're not happy with the withdrawal agreement, they want to take it in a different on a different course, I think you'd see a lot more defections from the Conservative Party. You could see the majority of Theresa May with the DUP entirely undermined, which would effectively force a general election. So there are a lot of what ifs in that. No. I don't think there are any guarantees, but I think what is guaranteed is that they will be running candidates in the European elections.
Yeah,
I can't see
and no deal is still a spectre there.
Well, the problem about Lucinda, I agree with what Lucinda said about a new Tory leader and all the rest. But what the new Tory leader then would do is go to Brussels to seek to reopen the withdrawal agreement. Brussels would say no, and then he would come back or she would come back and they would have no choice but to say we're going to crash out or contest an election on that platform. And that's a danger that remains for us.
Yeah. Paul Somerville.
Well, from a financial market point of view, it's been actually very quiet. I mean, sterling hasn't moved much since Christmas. For the last year and a half, basically, sterling is in the same place. We're trading about 86p, so it's about 15% off before the Brexit vote. So financial markets are very calm about this whole situation. They were betting that there would be some sort of postponement, and that's exactly what happened. These European elections are interesting because obviously Farage now has set up his new party. So the Conservatives are in a very bad situation here because they're going to leak votes everywhere. They're going to leak votes to UKIP. They're going to leak votes to the Brexit party. And generally people who are very hacked off with them anyway are probably going to turn to Labour. So Labour will really want to see these European elections. So I can't see the Labour Party bailing out the Conservatives of any description. What happens after that? Well, I would suggest Michael Gove will definitely become the leader of the Conservatives. But a curveball from the left field, I would actually see that there might be some challenge to Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. He seems very reluctant to have a referendum, considering that it's the party, you know, that is the policy of the party. And I wouldn't be surprised, you know, well, you know, it's a small hope in my view, but that Hilary Benn becomes the leader of the Labour Party and then becomes the next Prime Minister. That's my outside chance, like the Grand
we may find ourselves in the ludicrous position of having a general election in the UK, who is causing all this problem, while we in Ireland are not having a general election because of Brexit. I mean, I think it's really crazy. We should be going ahead at this point now it's a long enough gap, it seems to me, is next part, the end of October, Halloween.
I think the European elections are much more interesting when you talk about other countries rather than the UK. Italy, for an example, you know, could be an absolutely focal point for another European crisis in the next few years. And I don't know if everybody's aware, but Lega, you know, who are the minority in the government at the moment, a very anti-immigration party, are doing fantastically well in the polls, and they are going to really sweep the board, and they, you know, are hooking up with Le Pen in France, and I would suggest these European elections are going to be the most interesting European elections we've ever seen, because I think there's going to be a wave of populist parties that are going to do well.
And people seem to be accepting that a third of the MEPs next time out are going to be some form of Eurosceptic disruptors. Yes?
Absolutely. But I mean, that has been, it's been a slightly smaller a percentage in the European Parliament for the last 5 years. But there has been a very boisterous and loud cohort from the extreme left and extreme right in the European Parliament. It's going to grow for sure. But I think that there will be a majority amongst the moderate parties of the centre left, centre right, the ALDE Liberals, EPP centre right, and SND Socialists, plus the Greens, who will come together to get legislation and policy through. I think it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the European Commission, because obviously we've seen a decline in the representation of the mainstream parties at government level. So currently, for example, you have 14 EPP commissioners. It's likely to be down to 7 or 8 in the next commission. You'll see the number of S&D socialists drop. ALDE will slightly increase, but you're going to have the Italian government, for example, and the Polish government nominating commissioners who could become very obstructive in the European Commission. We're not really talking about that very much, but I think it'll be
very
interesting.
And that's where the real power actually lies.
But that's where all of the legislation emanates from at European level, and they tend to be almost all decisions as a College of Commissioners tend to be by consensus. Very rare that there are votes taken. So, there's a real harmony between the 28 commissioners currently, including the UK commissioner, believe it or not. But that's likely to change. Even if it's only a small number, that'll become a bit of a thorn in the side. And I think it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out then in the
last
year.
Why Italy is so interesting is because of their debt. Obviously, they have 1.7 trillion euros of debt. Their economy isn't growing at all, and populism is rising. They've got over 33% youth unemployment. The fractions that are going on in Italy is extremely important to us. Because again, in Ireland, we are so pro-European, we don't really take into account what could happen in the next 5 years. I'll just give you an example. The politicians in Italy are talking about having a new euro bond Okay. Now, this basically would mean that Irish people would take on the debts of other European countries. Now, that's absolutely fascinating that nobody here talks about it. And that's back to the original story that we were talking about, John Delaney. I find it so uninteresting when these big stories are going
on
in Europe.
Eurobonds became part of Irish government policy during the financial crisis because we would have benefited from them.
Yeah, but going forward, if we have, like, for an example, you've got something like, you know, the Italian government have to issue about 400 billion worth of bonds this year. And most of the people who are buying those bonds are the Italian banks and the French banks. You know, we've got a serious problem with, say, Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank's market cap is about 16 billion and they've got about 40 trillion of derivatives. Okay? It's the biggest problem that we've got in Europe at the moment. Now, when you've got politicians that are certainly going to start talking about, well, maybe let's do this in a different fashion. You know, like the Italian politicians are talking about taking their gold back from the Bank of Italy and keeping it away from the Bank of Italy so it can't be taken off them by the European Commission.
This sounds very basket case.
All I'm saying is because the growth in Europe is so slow, like the German economy, for an example, is only growing by 0.8%. You know, the IMF have just lowered the growth targets three times already for 2019 growth rates. So the European economy is slowing. The world economy is slowing. And you can see that these problems could create populist governments that are again going, you know, especially in Italy, I would suggest, and they are going to have to go to the European Parliament and cause trouble.
Pat. But I think what it highlights is the number of serious problems that Europe ought to be tackling and that can't address because of the Brexit situation. I mean, even Macron and his Napoleonic self-impression, obstructing a longer, more sensible postponement was not a constructive thing for him to have engaged in. And that's before you
Hungary. But hang on, is Macron not saying Europe has a lot of problems to deal with, a lot of them are going to crystallise in these European elections, and we don't want it to be about Brexit, and we don't want it to be about disruptive Britons when we have serious problems, as outlined by Paul there, to deal with.
Yeah, he's saying that, but the Brexit issue is real, whether we like it or not. And if you gave it a longer period, and remember, there's a two-year transition period after that, it was more constructive to allow a period of time when, you know, preparations could have been made. If there is to be a Brexit, that it is a softer Brexit.
I totally agree with Pat, and I'm quite a fan of Macron. I wouldn't be quite so critical. But I think, you know, like all French presidents, he's playing to a domestic agenda weeks in advance of European elections. He's been under huge pressure from the Gilets Jaunes, which is a bizarre collection of hard left, hard right insurrectionists, basically. And he's trying to claw back his popular support to win the European elections as the first serious electoral test since the general election in France, and that is his priority. And he was isolated at the European Council this week. He was the only one of all the prime ministers and heads of government pushing for this shorter extension. And I don't believe that he was doing it because of the European interest. He was doing it with an eye to European elections in his own country.
It is a good point as well made by Paul in terms of the fact that it is constantly pointed out here that we are very much pro-EU. We have one of the highest statistics in terms of support of the European Union, but the engine is the economy, and we're in a position right now where, you know, in to use Fine Gael speak, they keep the recovery going, etc. Like, we're not in a bad place, but if that were to change, as outlined by some of the points that you made, it will be interesting to see if we, because we have so far been somewhat immune to that swing to the right that we've seen around the EU, and, you know, just how much longer that can continue. I think that's kind of contingent on the economy itself. And, you know, it's
I think, in fact, I think Ireland has completely benefited. It's one of the countries that has most benefited from the policies of the central banks. The central bank, I mean, the ECB, get this number, the ECB has printed 4,500 billion euros and shoved it into the European economy.
Now, it's gone into Irish property, Irish shares.
It's gone into asset prices. So it's created asset price inflation all over the world. Share prices. Now, for an example, the American stock market's near all-time highs. Those companies are in Ireland, so the people who are working for those companies are getting very well paid. And this is all about central banks and how they're pushing
And Paul, am I right in thinking that we don't have that armory for the next downturn?
Well, exactly.
It's pretty much exhausted at this point.
If the world economy is slowing down, we're going to get the GDP numbers out of the USA in the next week or two. I expect them to be much lower than last year. So if you've got a world economy that's slowing and central banks are really have their foot to the floor with emergency policies that we've been using for many years, there's nothing left in the tank if the world economy is to slow. And again, the only reason the stock markets are doing so well is they believe that central banks are going to have to continue to do this. For an example, in China, the biggest credit bubble of all time, but Chinese government are printing. It's absolutely unbelievable what they're doing there. So maybe we'll have some improvement in the European economy in the second half of the year. But in general, you know, there's major problems coming down the road, but we're talking about Brexit and John Delaney.
Yeah, OK. Just before we leave it go, Jerry Stenbridge, our much vaunted Europhilia and how positive we are about Europe, we weren't always like this, were we? It's really since the whole Brexit thing that we have become such staunch Europeans.
Yes and no. I mean, I think we were always hugely Europhilic, but there was a tendency to become more critical of it, particularly when we weren't, you know, getting as many billions from them as we used to get. But yeah, definitely Brexit has brought it back.
We're all on the same page now, absolutely, aren't we? Let's talk about the Children's Hospital, which is still in the papers today. And Jennifer, you've been covering this all week, and the Sunday Business Post page one today you were looking at.
Yeah, so obviously the report by the consultants PwC came out this week, and there was a lot happening on the news agenda this week, and I think a lot of it kind of went below the radar to some degree, especially in terms of the what was in that report. So in the papers today, in two different papers, including the Sunday Business Post, we see details about how tender documents from unsuccessful bidders were destroyed in the months after the bid was secured. I mean, the PwC have described this as irregular, and obviously you mentioned at the start of the show about the statute of limitations, etc. So it does seem to be an issue that we'll probably see explored in the coming weeks. Why were those documents destroyed? In a response, I think, to the Sunday Business Post, the spokesman for the National Children's Hospital board said that it was in line with their policy, but you know, we'd want to have a look at that policy. And I think in terms of the report itself and some of the most important things that came from it, from the outset, there were these red flags that were missed. And I'm talking specifically here where they talk about how, in the very beginning, the prices that were given by the different bidders were too low, and that obviously this price was never going to be doable. They say also that it's also worrying that the cost is likely to rise above $1.7 billion. We're at a position now, in that contract, we're protected up to 4% inflation. We're currently running at around 7.1. If that was to increase to 10% by this summer, that's an extra 91 million.
And there's a builder's play claim of, I think, 12% at least in now. I've seen a figure of 30% during the week, but there does seem to be a builder's play claim for 12%.
There is a builder's play claim. There's a lot of other things as well that could happen between now and then. There's design fees that I don't... And, you know, one quote that I would like to point out, which I think is damaging politically, they found that from the outset the project was, and I quote, driven by an imperative for timely completion within a cost envelope that was never adequate.
And Pat, this is in the Business Post, and Gene Kerrigan mentions it as well in his piece in the Sunday Independent. Nobody asked any questions of these guys, it appears. There were two levels of boards there, but there just doesn't seem to have been any interrogation of whatever they were presented with. They just kind of... And when the business case was made to Cabinet, according to the Business Post, they're basically saying that the design at that point, design still not finalised, hadn't been at that point. They were kind of notional figures. But are politicians and administrators, are they kind of putty in the hands of people like this? And if you have a promoter bias among a politician, he just wants to get the thing done. There was nobody asking questions.
Well, I think you'd be very fortunate to get a minister who would have the skills or the courage to embark on a project like this. That's why it was handed over to the who's who of the construction industry. I mean, there was a committee put together of the most prominent people in the industry. And, you know, I think all kinds of things have come to light now. The procurement process itself seems to me to be badly in need of renovation. Mm. I mean, the notion that, for example, you would always take the lowest price is a painful learning experience. It's ironic, I think, that the successful bidder here was unsuccessful in the other big building project in Dublin, the Grange Gorman University, Technological University of Dublin.
I don't know if we can bring that into it, but Pat, we should say that BAM offered to walk away from this.
No, no, but
they said if you want to redo the contract, we will.
I
say the government was glad to have BAM because they said no. They came out very quickly and said no. We're proceeding as is, and it seems to have emerged from this report. It would be more expensive now to.
The only point I wanted to make was that they threatened litigation when they weren't successful in that project, and it delayed it for the best part of 18 months with serious consequences. Now, in this situation, I'm not very impressed. I don't know why everybody is so impressed by BAM promising to walk away. I don't think that, that was anything other than a PR statement at the time.
It seems to have put it up to the government to say, look, if you want to get someone else to do this...
But sure, the government is stuck with it now. There is a massive expenditure already and a huge hole at James's... with the benefit of hindsight, and one of the reasons for the imperative of the hurry that you talked about was the fact that this is in discussion for 30 years and actively for 20 years. And, you could make an argument, as I did, for the 27 acres of land adjacent to the Talla Hospital and say that it is easier communication-wise from Tipperary or Mayo than is James's or the Mater. Or you could say that the Connolly site, all these things in hindsight, but it seems to me now, there's no going back.
The longer-term political damage, it seems to me, is that it's completely shredded Fine Gael's reputation for, fiscal rectitude. I mean, this is a core Fine Gael thing, and for their own supporters as well as the ones who, come on board at different times to vote to them. But it's gone now.
And that
it's
is
gone.
The most damaging aspect for Fine Gael, is that they constantly point towards Fianna Fáil and say, these guys wrecked the economy. Yeah. We are the responsible pair of hands. But when you have, this €1 billion overspend, it's very hard to maintain that case. And the other thing I would say, just on putting it up to, as Pat mentioned, putting it up to the government in relation to BAM, the National Children's Hospital Board and the government, when they found out about this massive cost overrun, sat down and said, right, what are our options? Option A, continue. Option B, get a new bidder. And they found that there would be limited, pretty much no interest internationally and limited interest domestically, because we have all these other big projects now which are more beneficial and more attractive. So, there was never really another option. And that was the case actually from the beginning. If you look at the procurement process, this was doomed to come in over, the amount that it came in at. And the government didn't have a choice. They did. They could have tried to find another bidder, but you're talking about hundreds of millions extra and like a delay of 2, 3, 4 years.
And we should point out, in the interest of balance, that the government say it was doomed to come in more than was planned, because too little was planned. The cost was planned too low in the first place. So there's a kind of a chicken and egg situation there. Well, the reason it's gone over is because we undershot. Lucinda, do you have a view on it?
Well, I certainly do. I have lots of views on it. I think the first thing is that there appears to be no rigour. So, I saw this when I was a city councillor, the inability of the state to really engage, or state agencies or state bodies or local authorities to engage in a meaningful process for public private partnerships, for procurement. There are huge flaws in the system. There's a lack of expertise internally in government departments to actually hold bidders to account and to understand the complexity. And that's something that we need to address. It's not sufficient to say, well, we don't have the skills and we have to rely on the construction industry or whoever else to sort of fill the gap for us. That's just not... It's not an acceptable answer. That's the first thing. My huge concern about this, I think it was always inevitable it was going to overrun. The costs were never realistic. But my huge concern is, and it goes back to the point Pat made about Talla, is that, we have a burgeoning population. We have high net immigration, which is going to continue because we have a huge need for immigration across our sectors in this country. We have, you know, we have indigenous high birth rates, et cetera, much higher than most of the rest of Europe. And this site will not be adequate. This hospital will not be sufficient in probably 10, 15 years' time. And then what happens? Why weren't we looking at a large site? And if necessary, relocating one of our acute hospitals, which are creaking in any case, and none of the facilities for any of our hospitals in the city centre are sufficient or adequate. So why didn't we just say, you know what, the initiative for the matter was wrong, it was flawed, it was politically motivated, etc. Huge mistake. Yes, loads of money's been wasted, but actually, aren't we better to cut our losses at this point and do it properly? But there was nobody prepared in government to say that and do that. And we are building what I believe will ultimately end up being a white elephant. And I think it's a shame.
OK, we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back, and our panel still here, Lucinda Creighton, Pat Rabbit, Paul Somerville, Jennifer Bray and Jerry Stembridge. And we're joined now, we want to continue with health. I'm joined by Dr. Matthew O'Toole. So 2,830 doctors left the Medical Council Register between 2015 and 2017. 700 GPs, that's out of about 3,000, I think, in the country, are due to retire in the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. GP practices turning patients away because they're oversubscribed. So, Matthew O'Toole, you're GP and president of the National Association of GPs.
I am.
What's the future looking like for the GP in this country?
Well, at the moment, I suppose, just to paint a picture, I mean, general practice is not in a very healthy state at all. So, as I said, if you look at the moment, about 70% of GP practices just aren't taking on new patients. And, I mean, the entire county of Monaghan is currently closed. So there are no GPs in Monaghan that can take on any new patients. That's a really dire statistic, you know. And, I mean, you've towns
like... So if you move to Monaghan... Or your
patients that come to me in Dublin.
Yeah.
But I mean, not only that, I mean, the commuter towns of Dublin. So you have Navan, Ashburn, you have Naas, for example, in Dublin, where now all GPs are at capacity. I got two phone calls this week from patients in Kildare, so young families that have moved to Kildare and just can't find a GP. So it's quickly becoming the norm. Like, I used to get calls from TDs because their patients couldn't get a medical card. Now they call me because their patients can't get a GP. So the situation at the moment is quite dire.
Do you know what percentage of, say, that 2,830 doctors who left the Medical Council Register between 2015 and 2017, how many of them are GPs, or do we have any idea?
Well, what we know, and again, I mean, we don't actually have the actual breakdown of it, but we know that about 25% of those are specialists, so that they're GPs or consultants. And what's really worrying about that figure from the Medical Council is that those are people that have left the Medical Register. So what they're saying to us is, I'm out of here, and they're not coming back. I mean, the figure for 2018 is there are 120 doctors leaving Ireland per month at the moment, are actually leaving the Medical Register. And if you look at the figures, I mean, we actually train more doctors in Ireland than any other country in the OECD. And what the report from the Medical Council actually stated is that we're becoming increasingly dependent on doctors that are trained abroad. It just doesn't make any sense.
So we're spending a quarter of a million roughly to train a doctor?
Yep.
To send them off, and then we're having to entice doctors to come
abroad.
Here.
Yeah.
Why are we letting them all go away? Would there not be an argument that if the state is investing 250,000 in somebody, that you would say to them, you need to work in the health service for 5-10 years?
Yeah, well, we're not letting them away. We're actually driving them away. Like, I have a lot of my friends out of my class that have decided that, you know, they're moving to Australia. And I mean, it's not an easy decision that to make. I mean, you're leaving behind your family, your friends and your entire life to move halfway across the world. But I would say we're not letting them away. We're actually driving them away. I mean, if you look at the report...
What are they saying to you? Are they going because of money?
No, they're not. And interestingly, what the Medical Council report showed is that the single biggest country that's attracting our doctors is actually the UK. So there's a huge drive at the moment to attract doctors at the moment with Brexit. There's a huge fear that there will be, and there is a shortage at the moment of doctors in the UK. And doctors in the UK are paid about the same as they are in Ireland. So it isn't money. And if you look at the report from the Medical Council, everybody that left the register was asked, why are you leaving? And money was very far down on the list. The reason they're leaving is because the working conditions in Ireland are driving them away. So I can tell you from a GP perspective, GPs in Ireland work between 10 and 12 hours a day now. And they're seeing more patients, they have less time. I spoke to a GP yesterday who's currently pregnant, and she has to make a decision whether she's going to give up on general practice or whether she's going to come back after doing a week of work, after having a baby within a week. And that is the reality in Ireland. We cannot get GPs to cover us, so GPs can't take time off, they can't take breaks, and at the moment GPs aren't able to go on maternity leave, and that's what's driving people away.
There is a perception there, though, that if you are a GP and you're running a healthy practice, that, you know, people will complain mine, and I'm sure they say it to you. Mm. You know, I got in, he had me out the door in 5 minutes, and that was 60 quid. So are they making good money, these GPs?
So, I mean, at the moment, in terms of what GPs are earning, they're earning, I suppose, what their colleagues are earning in the UK. But the problem at the moment, as I said, it's not money. I mean, as I said, at the moment in Ireland, we've 26 communities without a GP. As of Friday morning, and I just checked it up, there are 165 jobs for GPs in Ireland. I mean, James Riley in 2011 said to us that, you know, GPs and doctors would be coming from abroad to work in Ireland, including the UK. What we're seeing is the reverse. As I said, my generation of GPs are actually going to the UK. So it's not about the money, it's the fact that the working conditions in Ireland are driving them away, like the health service is failing patients and failing doctors.
So is the money good then to make up for all this? What do you earn?
I earn about 75 grand a year. I earn a third of what the Minister for Health earns, and I studied for 10 years to be a doctor and to be a GP, and that's the reality of it at the moment. And if I was to move to Australia, I would earn 3 to 4 times that. But importantly, I wouldn't be working 10 to 12 hours a day. I mean, what GPs are saying to me is that there's this pervasive sense of helplessness. I mean, I spend a third of my day apologising to patients. I was at work on Friday and I apologised to a patient who spent, you know, 3 days in a trolley. I apologised to my patients because they're spending 2 years on a waiting list. The whole system is dysfunctional. And what doctors are saying to me is that when they're working in the UK or Canada, they can work to their full potential. Like, as a GP in Ireland, I cannot order an MRI. I can't order a CT. I am forced to refer patients to the emergency department because I can't get access to any diagnostics. And it's the system that's broken and it's breaking doctors. That's what's happening.
So you can't get people the care they need, essentially.
No, and I'll tell you, like, I work in the north inner city of Dublin, and I also work in a practice that's about a stone's throw away from here. So in the north inner city in Dublin, I can't get access to anything at all. If my patients need to get their hip done, they will wait 2 or 3 years, and they're not waiting, they're coming back to me with the same problems. If you have private health insurance in Ireland, Brendan, you can get your hip done in a week. If you don't, it'll take 2 years, and that is just not right.
Paul Somerville, it's from a kind of economist perspective, analyst perspective, sounds like a system that's very broken, is it?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is a story that, you know, has been going on for many years. We spent 17 billion on the HSE and we don't really ever get the answers to where the money's going. So I would suggest, you know, from the doctors' union point of view, you know, it's a very sad story that you paint and a very sad picture. But I would like to see the doctors say, well, hold on here. Where can we save money within the system to hire more doctors? I'd like to see the same with nurses. I'd like to see the same with the whole system, because basically, this programme nearly every week covers the HSE, and there's really bad stories about what happens in the HSE. It's obvious that it doesn't work. The HSE as a whole, as a body, does not work. Full of middle management, full of people getting paid humongous amounts of money near the top, and yet the nurses and the doctors are really suffering. So again, it's a story that we've heard for many, many years in Ireland, but nothing seems to be ever done, and there's no accountability. So I would suggest from the grassroots, instead of coming onto the programme and saying, obviously you've outlined the, you know, very, very well what the problems are, but I would suggest the doctors need to go, hold on here, we know where the money is being spent and being wasted, and we want some of that money.
Yeah, well, I'm blue in the face telling people, but no one's listening to me. So the solution is very simple. We spend about 3% of the overall health budget in primary care in Ireland, which is about half of what they spend in the UK and about a third of what they spend in developed countries that have developed health services.
And we are like told that primary care is the solution to the sclerosis in the system.
I mean, we have so many reports and so much data. Like, GPs can do so much, but our hands are completely tied. I mean, for every euro that's spent in primary care, you save 5 euros across the health service. So what we need to do is move from a hospital-centric model where everything happens in the hospitals, which costs 10 times more. Like, I can do minor surgery in my clinic for 100 euros, which costs well over 1,000 euros in the hospital. But everything is hospital-focused. Everything goes towards the hospital. And what we're hearing is so much lip service. I mean, Sláinte Care is all about moving everything out to the community. But what we're seeing is absolutely no action whatsoever. And I mean, I've heard this, you know, the transfer towards a GP model of care, you know, GP-led community primary care for the last 10 years. We have had zero action on that one, and it's very frustrating.
It's interesting what Paul says about hire more doctors, because most GPs don't actually kind of work directly for the HSE, do they? They're kind of in this weird thing of being these kind of like sole traders, shopkeepers out around the country.
Yeah, we're in a kind of weird limbo, and I would describe GPs as false self-contracted, because basically, or false self-employed, should I say, because basically we earn the vast majority of our income from contracts in the HSE, so we have none of the benefits of working for the public sector, and I suppose all of the downsides. So as I said, we don't get a pension, we don't get leave, annual leave, anything like that at all, or the system certainly isn't as good as it is in the public sector. But, I mean, we have a huge shortage of GPs. We've 62 GPs per 100,000 of the population, which is half of that you have in Canada and Australia. But as I said, what we need to do is just reorientate the health service. Like at the like Einstein said, you know, doing the same thing again and again, expecting the same result or a different result is the definition of insanity. And that is what we're doing year on year, pouring more money into the hospitals and going nowhere.
So you would describe it as a political failure then? You would describe the politics is not working, not the hospitals aren't working?
No, and I mean, we have this plan called Sláinte Care, the purpose of which was to take politics out of healthcare. But as I said, what we're doing is spending more. I mean, we spend, I think, the highest amount of money per capita outside of countries like the United States in terms of health and in terms of accessibility. We're right at the bottom in terms of the OECD. So now, we're doing it wrong.
There is a new GP deal agreed, isn't there? And the GP's not happy with it?
Well, it's not a new GP deal. I mean, there was a 40% reduction in terms of the overall funding allocated to general practice over the last 10 years. €1 billion was actually taken out of general practice. And what this government has done is over the next 4 years has committed to reversing that. But we're left with the funding mental problem that we have a contract that's 50 years old and that is completely not fit for a purpose. And what we need to move towards, again, is a system where the GP is at the heart of the health service, and whereby when people go to hospital, that is a failing. We need to do as much as we can in the community. So it's certainly a first step, but we need to do a lot more. As I said, the expectation that GPs work 365 days a year and provide a 24/7 cover just isn't safe for patients and not for doctors.
Pat Robert.
Well, I have to confess, I normally listen to spokespersons for GPs with a small pinch of salt. But I have to say that that's a very cogent, rational statement of the position, which is quite scary for citizens. If we are to ramp up primary care, and we all agree that that seems to be central to correction of the problem, you can't do that without doctors. And it's extraordinary if we are educating, training more doctors than almost anywhere in the OECD, that we are left with this shortage. And it seems to me that there must be some method of addressing that issue, because it seems absurd that we are importing doctors from the developing world and exporting ours to... And I take Matthew at face value when he says that it's not just about earnings in terms of the outward brain drain. I can't see how we're going to construct a primary care centre if we have a brain drain of doctors from here. And you know, it really is very difficult to understand for a small population of less than 5 million people that we can't put together a health service that works.
And why did you decide to become a GP, Matthew?
I decided to become a GP because my own GP at home, a doctor called Eddie Herty, inspired me to become a doctor. And my plan always was actually to replace him. And I did 10 years of training, became a GP, and then he retired. So my dream job actually became available. But I, because ashamedly, I didn't apply for it. I left my own community without a doctor, which included my own parents. And the reason for that was I could not do the job he was doing. I mean, he was working 100 hours a week, and I can vouch for that. And he was working 100 hours a week because he was providing on-call services for at least 36 hours period once a week, and he was working for 48 hours every second weekend. But also in his last year of working, he did not take a single day off. He was sick for 1 week the year before that, and our community was left without a doctor. And this guy was in his late 60s, and I just couldn't do the job he was doing.
There was probably an older generation of GPs who were kind of took it for granted that that's how they operated around the country, and we are seeing a lot of them retiring now, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, we have about, you know, between 600 and 700 GPs that are due to retire in the next 3 to 5 years. You're right, they're the older generation of GPs, but I mean, general practice now is a female predominant specialty, and I think it is only fair that they're allowed to have children and kids and have a life. I'm not saying that I want a life, but what I'm saying is working 100 hours a week, I don't know how they did it. I don't know how they were able to operate safely. And frankly, I don't know if I'd want my child to see a GP who had worked 100 hours that week. It's insane.
Is the under 12s a good move? as far as the GPs are concerned? They're now going to get free GP care. Will they be clogging up the surgeries as well?
The problem is capacity. So as I said, 70% of GP practices at the moment aren't taking on new patients. So like, it's great to give people keys to a house, but if the house is full, you're not going to get access. And that's the problem.
Jerry.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, the question is never, I think, put to the doctors. What I'm saying is the issue doesn't arise. That doctors want to stay here. Students want to stay here. They want to enter a system that they perceive to be fair to their patients, and that wherever they end up, that those patients will get the same treatment as, whether you're in Coolock or Sandymount, that they will get the same treatment. And the truth is, this is what GPs are finding. And they're ending up trying to, as you say, apologise to people all the time because they're not getting what should be their right to get. And we are unable, it seems, to create that sense of loyalty to the system. We can't create loyalty to the system if we are treating patients unfairly.
Obviously, and the cost GPs, of living is also a huge issue. If you're a young doctor coming out of college and you can't afford a house, of course you're going to go to Australia where they want you and it's easy to buy a house and the economy is doing extremely well. I mean, it just makes total sense. So it's the joined up thinking that is lacking in this whole debate about
But it's not about money, though.
How our system operates and is run. I mean, again, people talk about going to Australia. Well, Australia's running a budget surplus, a very good one, and obviously because China's doing so well, Australia's doing very well. But in general, we seem to have no planning here about how we spend our money and what we do with our money. It's always crisis talks. So we have a doctor in here, and he's explaining very, very well an extreme crisis. And once this crisis comes, then we try and act. I mean, it just seems to me that it's the political failure that every year in, year out, it's a political failure, and the system does not work very well. And the HSE has never worked. No matter how much money you give it, it is still not going to work.
Okay, Matthew O'Toole, that was certainly very clear and stark. Thank you very much. And we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marian Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Now, welcome back, and our panel are still here. Lucinda Creighton, Pat Rabbit, simmer down, Paul Somerville, Jennifer Bray and Jerry Stembridge. And you know what? Because we did go down a little bit of a grim road there for a while, we're going to take one bit of a good news story that Lucinda Creighton was adamant she wanted to include.
Well, there's a lovely picture on page 2 of the Sunday Independent, which is a painted horse, which is painted as a zebra, which was apparently a dream of The Edge from U2. And it's painted by the artist Duda. And it's a lovely picture of a little boy with a little teddy. And it's basically promoting a nice initiative to raise money for the Injured Jockeys Fund. The photograph was taken at Naas Racecourse yesterday. There's 21 life-size horses which are being painted by some of Ireland's most prominent artists. And obviously it's kind of entering into the flat race season, the opening of the Curra, Derby Day, etc., coming up. So, just a nice positive one.
Tell us quickly why The Edge wanted an Arabian horse painted like a zebra.
Well, it just says, I've always loved zebras, but as a kid, I discovered that they could never be tamed or ridden like their cousin, the horse. And that was his fantasy. A cross between an Arabian horse and a zebra. Isn't that lovely?
Okay, good man, The Edge. Maya Dunphy, welcome.
Well, does he want to ride zebras? Is that it?
You're very literal. It's poetic. He's thinking about this. The
I'm
zebra
not literal.
Is this
I'm just messing.
Almost a That's mythical all. Creature that can never be broken. It's like a unicorn. And so he wanted the agreeableness of a horse, but with the wild spirit of a zebra. I don't want to speak for the Edge, but I think that's roughly what the Edge is getting at.
They haven't actually paid to the horse.
It's a
painting of a horse.
It's a life-size model of a horse.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad we clarified that. Now, we all like a good laugh, and everybody argues over what their favourite sitcom is and what's funny and what's not funny. So this week, the Radio Times magazine published a poll of the top 20 sitcoms ever. The definitive top 20 sitcom ever this time, yes.
Deemed by the Radio
So
Times.
Maya Dunphy is going to give us her view on it now. So Maya, do you want to tell us a bit about the list of shows that made the list?
To end on a light note, the Radio Times published every few years. These lists come out of the greatest comedy. But it's very difficult. Comedy is not a science, as I think everybody here knows. So, you can't be right or wrong. It's an art. So even discussing comedy really is kind of futile. And it depends on who's running the survey. In the Radio Times, I would assume most people who were questioned or who voted in this were probably over 50, maybe over 60. So then nostalgia comes into play. I think with comedy, nostalgia, it has no place. Like, nostalgia is a strange thing. It's uniquely human and it's fairly useless most of the time, apart from giving out unwelcome advice or for Christmas movies. But aside from that, nostalgia is not the most helpful thing in the world,
I think.
But I'm not saying that these. No, let's start up. So Fawlty Towers is a classic, but only 12 were ever made. It's a 70s one. Then we have Father Ted.
But does everyone not agree on Fawlty Towers, roughly? Quickly around the table. You'll rarely get someone who'll say, no, I don't get
Fawlty
Towers.
But even people who haven't seen Fawlty Towers think it's best.
We've all seen it about 10 times at this stage. I think your children have practically seen it already when they're born at this stage. We have a little Fawlty Towers clip.
Manuel, there is too much butter on those trays.
Okay.
There is too much butter on those trays.
No, senor. What? Not on those trays. No, sir. Uno, dos, tres.
I'm mucho burro Ali. Nothing, dear. I'm just dealing with it.
He speaks good, how you say?
English. Oh, I don't know why you wanted to hire him, Basil.
Because he's cheap and keen to learn, dear. And in this day and age...
But why did you say you could speak the language?
I learned classical Spanish, not the strange dialect he seems to have picked up.
Everything you need to know about Brexit is in Fawlty Towers.
But are we all laughing at, you know, the Spanish guy is stupid and everything? Would you get away with that now?
No, you wouldn't. You simply wouldn't. Now, that's pure farce and it's brilliant. But can you imagine putting that into a comedy today? You'd be accused of cultural appropriation and racism. And I was at a friend's house the other week
everyone
and her
was
niece
laughing.
Was there. Because it's brilliant. Well, I was talking about Barcelona. Pretty Woman with a friend of mine, her niece who's 14. With a frown said to me, oh, Pretty Woman, that was a film about the prostitute who had to rely on a rich man. I said, please don't, it should be banned. We're starting a petition in school to have that film banned. I went, oh, that was a huge part of my childhood. But what was funny, what was deemed funny in the 70s wouldn't really be allowed now. It doesn't mean it's not funny. But can you imagine an actor like you know, the late great Andrew Sachs putting on a Spanish accent and saying, gay? It wouldn't be allowed. Doesn't mean it's not funny. It was pure farce.
Everything is problematic now.
Tom Kirk has a good article today in the Business Post where he's juxtaposing Fawlty Towers with Brexit. No, it's a pretty good one. Yeah.
Brexit's all about nostalgia.
Well, exactly. But he's pointing out, which I wasn't aware of, that BBC have actually banned a couple of parts of episodes of Fawlty Towers.
I hadn't heard that. Yeah,
so there you go now.
Okay, Maya, we go on down the list. Father Ted, number two, and again, sure, nobody disagrees on Father Ted.
No, exactly, and it's a classic.
I'm Alan Partridge. Alan Partridge was back again recently, and I think this is the first Alan Partridge they're talking about, is it?
Yes, I think the recent remake is amazing. If you're a fan of Steve Coogan, I think you love Alan Partridge. I don't know if the panel love him, but it's it's that awkward comedy that came into vogue in the 90s. And some people, if you have to explain why something is funny, then you're already, you know, on the back foot fighting a losing battle. But I think Alan Partridge is brilliant, very much that kind of mockumentary style of comedy. Then The Office followed that.
Does the list include The Big Bang?
No, it doesn't. And you know what, Pat? That's one that I never got into.
That's amazing, really. Yeah.
Pat Rabbit is a fan of
The Big Bang Theory.
Good absolutely, God. Yeah.
Well, I'll throw another into the mix because, you see, I think it was a British list, wasn't it?
Yes.
Because
the Radio Times.
Because, you know, I agree with Fawlty Towers.
Or is it they only included British ones? Yes.
All right, because
if it was an RTE guide list now, it would be very different.
I agree about Fawlty Towers, with the one exception, and that's Frasier. I think Frasier is the greatest.
Really? That's the greatest one for you.
But this is the thing, it's so subjective. It is like, you know, trying to choose what is the greatest book of all time or the greatest painting of all time. It's completely subjective. Yeah. The greatest songs, it's always going back to the Beatles and Elvis. Yeah. Whereas if you ask people under 30, under 25, you'd get very different responses. Are they right or are they wrong? No, not really.
Lucinda, yours?
My favourite sitcom of all time. Oh my God. I love Fawlty Towers, and I love the fact that there's a limited number of episodes, because it's sort of testament to
just how outstanding
only 12
the comedy was. Yeah, I love it. I love Father Ted. I mean, I love watching comedies, to be honest.
Paul Somerville, when you're not being a prophet of doom, what makes you
Seinfeld without doubt. Yeah. Seinfeld would be my number one by far.
Yeah, it probably is for
prophet
me as well.
Prophet of Doom,
I think,
is a great name for a sitcom. I'm going to write that one down.
Yeah, well listen, there's your star there. Just observe Paul Somerville for a few weeks. I want to go back to Alan Partridge because I have a clip and I'm determined to shoehorn it in.
Oh, I love
and
this
I think
clip.
So tell us about this clip now, because we should contextualise it, because again,
this is a clip from one of the early series of Alan Partridge, and it features Arthur Matthews and Graham Linehan as two Irish producers who have come over to talk to him about an idea for a show.
Okay, here we go.
So, how many people were killed in the Irish famine?
2 million, and another 2 million had to leave the country.
Right. I mean, if it was just the potatoes that were affected, at the end of the day, you will pay the price if you're a fussy eater. If they could afford to emigrate, then they could afford to eat in a modest restaurant. Could we come live from the Blarney Stone? I'm trying to get an angle on this.
See, Alan, I think you're increasingly moving towards an area we want to move away from.
Yep, you're absolutely right. Live TV can blow up in your face. Sorry about that. You must be sick of that.
What?
You know, being blown up, bombs.
I'm from Dublin, not from Dublin.
We're from Dublin.
All right. Yeah, but that's where you make them.
Now, everyone here laughing away all through that, laughing at the famine and everything. There are going to be people, Maya, who are offended by that.
And in the more recent incarnation of Alan Partridge, this time, which is on the last couple of months, he reprised an Irish character. He used a lookalike, Alan Partridge lookalike, who came on and ended up singing Come Out You Black and Tans, excuse me, on a BBC show. And I think sometimes people get offended on behalf of other people. And they say, oh my God, you're Irish, what's that? So I said, no, it's brilliant. And that clip is absolutely brilliant. But I think there has to be heart in it. And Steve Coogan has a real warmth and fondness for Ireland and our Irish people. And it's very much a parody, but not...
Can I just make a nerdy point just about that particular clip from Alan Partridge, that the writer-producer on that was Armando Iannucci. And that's a name that may not be well known, but he is very much a force with Alan Partridge, The Thick of It, and in America with The Veep. Yeah. So he's an extraordinary influence.
There's also,
DVD,
The Armando Iannucci Show. Did you ever see it?
I did, yes.
Which is one of my favourite comedies of all time. It's more a sketch-based show. Yeah. Absolutely genius, but it just seemed to
disappear. Oh, and Chris Morris as well.
Father Ted aside, Jerry Stenbridge, what's the greatest
Irish sitcom? I love Father Ted.
It would be the obvious answer. Is there another great Irish sitcom?
No.
No. I can't think of it. Path to Freedom was very good.
Oh, yes. Path to Freedom was great.
That's back up in the RT player now. People absolutely start watching it again.
Absolutely.
It was very good.
Yes, and it does qualify as sitcom. I mean, we do so little.
I'm very upset that Black Books isn't on that list. That is one of the best sitcoms ever.
Black Books is brilliant.
Yeah.
There's only 20 there. And then the idea of, can there be instant classics? I think now we're coming back to a time where people are being far edgier in comedy. And Sharon Horgan and Ricky Gervais, The Catastrophe and Afterlife, I think are two sitcoms
I like it a lot. We have seen, and it's Sharon Horgan and I guess with Derry Girls as well.
Derry Girls,
women used to be funny, we were told. And they seem to be at the vanguard now, aren't they?
Particularly learned to be funny, Brendan. Women just weren't a part of comedy because in the 70s it was all either class wars or it was middle-aged men and their social ambitions being thwarted. And women just didn't have a partner. But I think comedy
is Catherine Tate there?
No.
But she's the funniest ever.
She's brilliant. But comedy is sort of anthropological too, and it mirrors what society is doing. And women weren't in comedy clubs 40 years ago, and now they are.
It's funny that we're more humorous, or we regard ourselves as more humorous than the Brits. But actually, the Brits are the ones who write the comedy. I know about the guys we sent on Father Ted, we're an exception.
We're funnier in conversation. They have teams of writers.
We are. We had Dunphy on earlier.
They have a deep tradition. They have developed a tradition over 50 years
now
of comedy, which we've never done.
They put more into developing comedy than we do.
We all keep going on this for ages, I sense. Maya, thank you very much. Sorry we didn't have more time. I know. Well, we'll talk to you about it again.